there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, healthcare, science, discussions, debate, dialogues, a little bit of everything, some emails, and I hope answers to your calls here live on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. The purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, it was certainly a week, and last week I was gone and we ran an interview. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Bernie Siegel. And I couldn't escape the healthcare debate. I was down at my husband's, it was sort of a graduate school reunion. It was a retirement party for his thesis advisor. And of course, all of the graduate students had flown to the four winds and were doing all sorts of interesting things. And one of them, a Swiss, had returned to Switzerland. And I had a very interesting conversation with him, somewhat bemused, precise Swiss man who told me a little bit about his healthcare system. I was interested in that because what they have in Switzerland actually sounds a lot like what we are talking about right now with the current proposals from the Democrats on the table. It's basically a private system. Everyone has to have health insurance. There is no exclusion for pre-existing condition. Your health insurance is portable. And it is paid for by your employer and by you. Depends on the situation. If your job is really low end, it's also paid for by the government. We're sounding more and more like the system that's being proposed here. Doctors take all of the insurance plans. There's really no problem in choosing or maintaining your relationship with a physician. And he was pretty much happy with his access to healthcare services. Didn't feel like he was being controlled by government death squads, death committees. And overall, it sounded like a pretty rational, sensible system. Now, the debate in the last week or two since the congressional recess has been anything but sensible and rational. And when I think of the millions of dollars being thrown at ads, which are, well, just quite simply lies. It's very, very frustrating to me because we really are talking about an important social issue that deserves to have a sensible debate and dialogue and not a lot of, well, lies. And instead, what we have is we have weapons of mass destruction. Yes, that's what the death committees are. It's the WMD of this issue. And we all know what happened with the weapons of mass destruction. There weren't any. They were a rhetorical device to scare us. Well, enter the death panels. They are not a reality. They are smoke and mirrors. They are a rhetorical device to scare us. And, you know, I get frustrated. If we are stupid enough as a people to fall for this, if people are so wedded to their preconceptions about quote-unquote big government that they will grab on to something like this and actually buy it, well, then I guess they get the health care they deserve. It's kind of interesting, actually, a study just published on the subject of the device, or rather the provision, I should say, that currently is in Medicare. I might add it was passed just a couple of years ago under the Bush administration. It's nice provision, actually. What it says is that if I sit down with a patient and spend time talking to them about the end of their life, talking about living wills, talking about durable power of attorneys, the way I usually tell people, if you have a stroke or a heart attack and are on a ventilator and it looks like you're going to be on the ventilator forever, would that be okay? Or would you want one of your family members or someone you trust to be able to decide to pull the plug if you were in a vegetative state, for example? And most people are like, yeah, my daughter Barbara is the person who's level-headed that I would trust to make that call. And so we fill out a form and daughter Barbara's on the hook should, in the unlikely event that that's how things wind up at the end of a person's life. Now, I do that because it's the right thing to do. I also do it knowing that A, won't get paid for it, and B, am cutting into my income to do it. But I do it because it's the right thing to do. All over the country, primary care doctors every day do stuff that's the right thing to do because it's congruent with their values and the reason they became primary care doctors. And they do it also knowing that they're being a patsy, because by doing this, they're the ones who are taking the hit financially. They can't bill Medicare for this. So it was nice when they said, we'll pay for this. It's a long cry from a death panel. And in fact, a recent study published in, this last Journal of the American Medical Association, looks at patients who received counseling, all had had terminal cancer, so they were all dying. And half got usual care, and the other half got some counseling about managing symptoms, when and how to access hospice care, and how to communicate with healthcare providers. The same sort of stuff that was on that quote-unquote death panel provision. And of course, as you would be, I'm sure, surprised to learn, the people who got the extra counseling were happier and felt better about their quality of life when questioned in a separate questionnaire. Well, surprise, surprise. Anyway, sometimes it makes me a little bit crazy. I do want to point out a couple of things about the ads. First of all, I've already mentioned the cost is just insane that people are throwing this money, which could so much better be spent in other areas, like, for example, paying for healthcare instead of paying for advertising. And just the sheer volume of ads and the targeting is nuts. It's like another presidential election. We've lost track of truth. We've lost the ability to have a sensible adult dialogue about social problems. Sometimes I kind of despair, because if the population is unable to have a dialogue about its values, if it's unable to communicate in a meaningful way, because all it's doing is ad-supplied slogans and they're firing off letters to Congress, the congressmen and women are going to decide with evidence that we're a bunch of idiots, and we're not. We need to do a couple of things. Those of you who are involved in this, and I hope that's everyone, please support the Democratic proposals. Please go out there and really push for the public option. The co-ops won't work. They'll just go bankrupt and dump a lot of people back into the no insurance thing. It's a no-winner. We've got to have a public option. And I personally think the public option is going to cost money, because I think it's all the people who are uninsurable by the insurance companies. And we basically need to mandate that they insure them, but we're not going to do that. So instead, we need to pick up the slack and make sure that people have access. If we can't come out of this with everyone having access, and that includes a mandate to purchase or pay for health insurance if you can, and a provision to provide it to you if you can't. If we can't do that and get rid of this pre-existing condition, then, like one of my favorite characters in one of my favorite all-time movies said, then we're stupid and we'll die. Let's go to our first caller. That is Jim in Big Sur. Hello, Jim, and welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. Nice to have you back.
Thank you.
I am ceaselessly amazed at the number of our fellow citizens who live their lives based on myth and make these important decisions through ignorance and gullibility. I have been sending out emails to my born-again sister and her hundreds of similar friends about what's real and what's a lie. But anyway,
do you think you're making a dent?
No.
And if not, why not?
Because they're about 50% of the country is interested in facts and has an open mind. They have open minds. Another 50% is afraid of facts and afraid to have an open mind and afraid to think. Whether you're talking about religion or healthcare, but a lot of these people are just hooked in to the right-wing media, which was constructed and effectively implemented about a quarter century ago.
Okay, so we will take it as read. At least I'm going to state this is my opinion, okay? It's my opinion that there's a television-wise, you've got Fox and you've got other manufacturing a worldview. And I'm wondering if somehow they've managed to link into people's spirituality so that to deny the conservative worldview is to somehow deny your religion.
Absolutely.
And is that the magic?
Absolutely.
Okay.
These people who have discovered a place they can go to get peace of mind in this crazy world, and that place is religion, are now linked to all of the crazies who also use religion for power and control and income. Mm-hmm. And so you're right. I think that these people, if they say, no, that's BS, then they're saying that to people they associate with and to their core belief about.
Right. So it essentially saying, you know, maybe there are no death panels is akin to saying Jesus Christ. Oh, never heard of him.
Right.
Okay. If that linkage is what's driving this, then maybe strategically what we should be doing is seeking to create the opposite linkage, like what health plan would Jesus vote for?
Use religion right back at them.
Yes.
That's an interesting idea. I saw a poll that showed that people who watch Fox, a very small number ever tune in to MSNBC or CNN. I like MSNBC and Rachel Maddow and Amy Goodman and Keith Olbermann because when they see the hypocrisy and the lies, they put it out there. They say, this is a lie and this is because, you know.
Right.
But people who watch Fox never watch these other programs. And that's what's happened to our country. We have all, now that conservatives have strong media, we've all gravitated and stick to exclusively that which feeds our beliefs.
Jim, I want to recommend a book to you, which I think you might find very interesting. It's written by a guy called George Lakoff.
And I have heard him interviewed.
Yeah, it's called The Political Mind.
Yeah, and I may have that book on my shelf because every once in a while interviews these people I buy that. I'll look for that.
Yeah, he's a cognitive psychologist, and he basically analyzes quote-unquote conservative thinking from a cognitive standpoint. And I think he has a lot of insight into how our brain circuitry works.
Right.
And I have to say it, I think that the conservative, particularly the far conservative in this country, have taken advantage of all of this government-funded research to construct a approach that exploits this information very effectively.
Right. And the other thing that's true, and the other thing George Lakoff talks about, which is what relates to what you just said, is that the right has very effectively learned how to communicate misinformation and lies and play on fears and religious associations. Just
and,
what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. One very last thing. I get on the email to my senators and Obama constantly saying, hey, we want the public option.
Good.
Now I recommend that to everybody.
Get all your friends to do it. And again, you're doing the right thing. You're going after your born-again sister. Rather than attacking those senators, I mean, the Democrats should never attack other Democrats who don't agree with them. You should sit down with them and attempt to bring them to your point of view. When you attack someone who's in opposition, and Obama has so got this, when you attack someone who's in opposition, you harden their opposition. When you sit down with them and say, I'd like to understand your point of view, and I hope that you'll be interested in mine, you soften the opposition. We've got to follow the very good example. We have finally got a good president. This is rare. We have finally got a good president. Let's use it.
Yeah.
Let's use it, folks. Okay. Well, you called in with an actual question, let you get to it.
Okay. About a year ago, my left calf started swelling when I would be sitting for a long time, mm-hmm. 3, 4, 5 hours. And then in May, all of a sudden one day, my upper left thigh was also swollen. I went to emergency. They did an ultrasound, and they found I had a 7-8-inch-long clot in my left leg.
Right. That was what I was thinking you probably had. Go ahead.
Right. So they put me on heparin and TPA mm-hmm. for 4 days and nights, dissolved the clot for the most part. And now my hematologist has said, you know, in about 10% of cases in which people have active, I've got, you know, a bunch of old clots from over the years, but in which people have active clots, and there's no known precipitating factor like injury or whatever, Mm-hmm. 10% of those people, for which we have no explanation for the clot, will have cancer.
Right. It's called a paraneoplastic effect.
Okay. So I recently had a CAT scan of my lungs and liver to determine whether there was anything going on there.
A fishing expedition.
Yes. Saying that if we do this and it's negative, we will be 90, 95% sure that there's no cancer in your body that was causing these clots or causing them to be an indicator.
Right.
My first question is, how wise is it to get a CAT scan, which I understand is about 300 times the amount of X-ray, chest X-ray radiation, or equivalent to roughly a year and three quarters in the upper reaches of Colorado or New Mexico? So that's one question. How wise and safe is it? And the second question is it that useful for what we're trying to do?
First of all, let's step back and reframe this, because you're falling into a cognitive trap yourself.
Okay.
And
that's why I called you.
Okay. So first of all, just to clarify, you've had a blood clot form in your leg without prolonged immobilization, without an injury or a blow to the leg, and you've had an evaluation which included checking for all of the abnormal proteins in your blood that might predispose you to clotting, and you don't have a problem with your protein C and your protein S and your antithrombin 3 and your Leyden factor and all of these other...
Leyden factor 5.
So they did all of those. Right.
Yeah.
They did all of those tests. And we know that we have identified some but not all of the problems with the clotting cascade. So there are other problems that we haven't identified and don't have tests for that you could have.
Okay.
So that's a given. Now, of the people that we can't identify, and this 10% figure is news to me, because last time I actually looked into this, which was 20 years ago when I was in school, we didn't have as many of the anticoagulant tests, so it was actually a higher number then. But now it's 10%, and I'll take that figure as read. So we've got a group of 100, 90 of them have one of these things we haven't identified, 10 of them will have a cancer which is unsuspected. That's where we're starting out with our pool of 100 people. So of that, 10 have a cancer that's unsuspected. And the question is, could you be in that 10%, or are you in the 90%?
Right.
That's the key. So if you're in that 10% probability of having and have cancer, will we find it? First question is, will we find it with a CT, lung, and liver?
Yep.
So is that the right place to be looking? Number two, if we find it in the lung or the liver, is there anything that we can do about it that will ultimately affect your survival? In other words, can we fix it? That's question number two. Question number three, and this is the one you started out with, but I actually think it's the third level question, is what is my cost in terms of long-term health and safety of doing the CT scan of the chest and the CT scan of the abdomen?
Yes.
Okay. So let's start with number three. Your CT scan of the abdomen, it's actually 3 years of background radiation. And that's the only number that we've got that we can quantify it with. But I think using background radiation as an indicator is dumb. The difference between taking a teaspoon of salt every day by mouth and taking an entire pound of salt on one day by mouth, I mean, obviously that's a very, very different thing for your body to have to deal with.
Yes.
And when you're talking about ionizing radiation, the idea that you can equate 3 years worth of ionizing radiation trickling in with one big dose is, you know, not sustainable.
Okay.
On the other hand, epidemiologically, we don't see a history of a CT scan as having a bump in cancer rates. And I think most people would agree that your body is capable of dealing with the radiation that comes from a CT scan. And the probability that you will induce a cancer with that CT scan is low enough that we've not been able to detect it.
If you don't keep going back, having more scans...
Precisely. And could there be a cumulative risk for people who are like going to do a yearly abdominal CT? I mean, there's people who are suggesting that you should have a total body CT every year. That is nuts. I mean, at that point, you probably will start inducing cancers just based on the proportionality of risk. But I don't ever feel that I'm taking a risk for the patient, and there's no data to suggest that I am. and people have looked carefully for epidemiological bumps in cancer risks with CT scans, and they haven't found it. CT scans have been around for 25, 30 years now, widely available. So if it was going to show up, it would have shown up by now. Maybe there's a small blip, but I think it's small enough to be not a serious risk. My big concern, really statistically speaking, is if you get this test and you find lung cancer, is there any probability that you can be cured? And I think the probability of a cure for lung cancer that's already causing a perineal plastic effect is low. And if you find it in the liver, realistically, unless it's a primary liver cancer, which would tend to show up with elevated liver enzymes, and I know those have been checked, it's going to be secondary metastatic liver cancer from another source, which means that the horse done left the barn and you probably aren't looking at a cure either, although you might be. So you've got a very small probability of finding something that you can treat that's going to affect your health outcome, and an even smaller risk of adversely affecting your health outcome. And you've got the cost of the study, let's call it $1,000. So if I were at the national level and I was trying to decide whether that was an appropriate thing to do, you know, if I was writing guidelines,
right,
I'd probably say no. There's not a big enough chance of benefiting this hypothetical individual to want to spend the money to do the test. But that's at the government level. At the doctor, I'm sitting in the room with you across from the table, I'd say, yeah, the chance of benefit is greater than the chance of harm. Maybe at least one, probably a couple of orders of magnitude. The chance of benefit is still quite small, but it's still significantly bigger than the chance of harm. So benefit outweighs harm. Cost is not outrageous. Let's do it. So I guess my answer is I would do the test. I would look at the cost benefit. I would recommend the test to another. I would do it in your boots. I would also go into it understanding that it's a can of worms and I may come out with a cancer diagnosis that I could have lived in blissful ignorance for another couple of years of, and that's going to affect my life track in a way that may or may not be positive, depending on what you do with your cancer diagnosis.
Actually, I would be surprised if that turns out to be the diagnosis.
Of course you would be, because the probabilities are against it.
If I had that information, all these trips I'm planning on taking over the next few years, as I can afford them, I'd
take
the hell with it. I'd max out the cards, and I'd travel around the world.
Then you've answered your question. Go get the CT.
So it's, I've done it.
So, okay, well, good. I'm glad I told you to do what you did.
Now, the name perineal, what's the rest of that effect? Perineal?
Oh, paraneoplastic.
Plastic?
Plastic. Neoplasm is the word for cancer. So neoplastic is an adjective form of that,
okay.
And then para means parallel or part of or associated with.
Okay, and it's the reliability of being CAT scanned when they say...
Well, it tells you don't have a cancer in the liver and you don't have a cancer in the lung.
And it's pretty reliable.
For that.
That information for that. Okay.
But you could have a cancer in your lymph nodes and you could have a cancer in your colon.
Right.
Well,
right.
Not in your colon because you got the abdominal CT. You could, you know, the prostate probably is still a possibility.
My doc said, we won't tell much about what's going on in the colon.
You can't prove a negative.
Right. Okay.
You can't prove a negative. Thank you very much for your call.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's talk now with Rebecca in Boulder Creek. Hello, Rebecca, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Don. How are you today?
Really good. Hi.
I have two things. One is a health question, and one is a statement about the healthcare debate.
All right.
Call it that.
Let's do the health question first.
Okay. I have a hiatal hernia, and it's lately been giving me a lot of problems with what they call silent reflux.
Yes.
And aggravating my larynx to the point that it closes up, and I'm not able to breathe.
Oh, okay. You're getting laryngospasm. Laryngospasm. We've all had that when we choke on something.
Right.
And you aspirate, you're talking and you're drinking and you suck some of the water down and then you start to cough and then you feel like you can't inhale. That's laryngospasm.
Right.
Nasty feeling.
It's very extreme where I wake up in the middle of the night out of a dead sleep, unable to breathe. I was in the ER on Sunday just because I couldn't get it under control. My question is suggesting possible surgery for the hiatal hernia.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how effective that is and how long it will last.
So we're talking about a Nissen fundoplication. There's been recently a lot of talk about this. Let me just frame it for you that this is a surgery where you pull down the lower part of the esophagus, pull it down under the diaphragm, and make a little tuck and create a sort of artificial valve and attach it to the lower diaphragm so that the stomach stays in the abdomen and doesn't pop up through the expanded hole in the diaphragm where the esophagus is supposed to go. But then when that hole stretches out, the stomach pushes up and you have a hiatal hernia. So that's the disease and that's the treatment. There's two ways to do the treatment. You make an open abdominal incision that takes longer to recover from because it's an abdominal incision. But the latest data comparing the open procedure with the closed procedure suggests, not too surprisingly, that the open procedure has fewer complications and is more effective. The closed procedure, where you do it laparoscopically, is harder technically, and so there are more mistakes made, so that the effectiveness rate is not quite as good. It is, however, much less of a surgery in terms of having a belly wound, and you don't have as much downtime, so it's cheaper for you because you don't miss work and et cetera. So,
exactly.
So when we talk about comparing the two, there's a lot of debate on that. And I think if you do decide to have the surgery, you want to look at the specific surgeon. If he's done the laparoscopic procedure, you want to look at his success rate. And you want to look at how many redos he's had to do and what the long-term success rate is for his patient cohort. All very hard information to get, but you sit down and you talk to the doctor and you want to know how his statistics stack up against the rest of the population. That's important. It lasts 5 to 10 years. You can pretty much assume that if you've got things that are driving the hiatal hernia, like you're overweight, you have increased abdominal pressure, you have bad collagen, so your diaphragm stretches out, whatever the factors are that led to your having this in the first place could continue to be active and cause a recurrence. But you're at risk. You've got a bad problem there. Now, you're doing all the right stuff, right? You've elevated the head of the bed. You don't have any water or fluid in your stomach for 2 hours before you lie down. You're doing all of the lifestyle things, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Very important that you continue to follow those even after the surgery.
Okay.
But laryngospasm, I consider a very bad symptom because that can lead to aspiration pneumonia. And if that gastric juice gets into your lungs, it's extremely irritating and can put you in the hospital. So
that's kind of what I feel like right now because I can't get rid of this cough.
Right. Well, the cough is unpleasant, but it's a reflex cough. But if you get gastric juice in your lungs, that's extremely dangerous. And it could, like I said, it could put you in the hospital. I don't know the specifics of your clinical situation, but yeah, that's the cough. I hear from what you've told me that you've got a pretty compelling reason to go forward with surgery.
Okay.
And the real question is open or closed. And I think you need to do some research on that. Where are you located?
Boulder Creek.
We talked about this pretty thoroughly on the August 8th show. So you could go to our archives at askdrdon.com and just look on the archives at the August 8th show. And the second topic discussed this fairly thoroughly. And then go to Dominican Library and have the librarians do a search for you on open versus closed fundoplication. And you can look at the latest information about success rates and failure rates and risks and complications. These will be very accessible articles because they're talking about things you can understand.
Right.
Not too esoteric. And I think it would be a good proactive thing for you to do before your next surgical visit.
Okay, great. I'll do that.
You had a comment, and I'd like to hear that about the healthcare.
Well, the comment is that in the absence of real information, people will create their own storyline. And so what I'm not seeing from our representatives and our president is real information about what the bill is saying. And I know it's very convoluted, and they make it very difficult to understand. And without that kind of real information, it's impossible to have a valid debate.
Okay, that's a legitimate point. I think that
I would like to see, like, you know, one portion of the bill in bullet points that say, this is what we're really trying to accomplish, this is what it's going to do, and then debate those bullet points versus the rhetoric that's going on right now. I get frustrated with the rhetoric from both sides of the conversation because there's no real information to talk about.
I have to disagree with you about there not being real information. It's there. I mean, you can go and you can look up a executive summary of the bill that's currently under discussion. The problem is it's not a firm bill yet. They're still debating all of these points. But you can look at the proposals and you can get a bullet point summary on that. because that's what I did when the recommendations came out of committee. And that was about, what, 4 or 5 weeks ago. But we did talk about it then. And that's essentially the same points that were on the table and how they would work. For example, this thing about co-ops, well, that's nebulous because it's not in the bill. It's not actually a proposal. And so, of course, it's nebulous because it's just an idea. I think the debate about what this bill will and will accomplish and whether or not the financing is realistic, that data is there, but it's not coming out in the newspapers. You actually have to go either online or into the archives of newspapers and look for it. It isn't being well presented by the press, and I would fault the press rather than the administration for that one.
Well, they have to work with the reality of the press, and
no, the press is, for the most part, I would say the press is going with the hot story of the moment, which is, you know, polls. Right now, yesterday, it's all about polls. Monday, it was all about, well, Obama said maybe we'll drop the public option. It's like there's a cloud outside. Let's call that the weather report. No, let's get the long range forecast and the probabilities, please. Not just the immediate blow-by-blow thing, but that's what they're doing, and we're getting so bogged down in the minutia that we're losing the big picture, and we really need a good sense for the big picture. So I totally agree with you, but I fault the press. I will fault the Democrats for letting...
You can't expect it to do something other than it's always done. So knowing that,
it's,
you have to come up with a solution.
Now, I'm going to disagree with you again there, because I think the quality of discourse in the press has deteriorated significantly over the last 10 years.
Yeah. So you can either fault the decline in discourse and fault the press, or you can find a solution.
Yeah, all right.
Faulting them is not the solution. It's just the reality.
Yeah, well, I guess my thought is the first thing you need to do is just ignore the people who are simply lying. Not even talk to them. I mean, my attitude now has become, before I even engage in a discussion with anybody, I want to assess whether or not they're lying. And if they're lying, I don't want to listen to them. I don't want to watch a show where they debate somebody that I respect, because it's like, okay, you're lying. You, therefore, have no credibility with me, and I really don't want to listen to somebody try to refute your lies. I would rather just switch the channel or go to a different website.
Which is why I don't rely on the media.
Yeah, okay.
My information.
All right, well, thank you. Yeah, you're making really good points. Thank you very much, and good luck with your problem.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now to Juan in Salinas. Hello, Juan, and welcome to the program.
Thanks. I get to talk to the Dr. Don. How are you?
Well, the Dr. Don is just fine. How are you? How is the Juan in Salinas?
The Juan in Salinas is teaching on a Saturday.
Oh.
Sometime this morning.
is this teaching the youth of America, helping them maybe have brain cells that are trained for critical thinking?
That is correct. That's right.
Right on. Okay.
Hey, my question is this. I heard the thing about the CAT scan, and this is, you know, kind of out of fear and curiosity. A couple of years ago, I think they needed to do a CAT scan on my knee, and they inject you with something before you do the CAT scan, like an hour before, right?
Right.
So the guy says, look, make sure you're not around anybody, you know, because of the radiation. I'm thinking in my head, okay, that's after the CAT scan. Okay, it was foolish, but that's what I was thinking. So after the CAT scan happened, I just happened to mention that I went shopping and all that. He says, you went shopping with somebody else? Well, yeah, with my wife, and I told her she was pregnant. And she goes, oh. I said, why? Is that a problem? Well, you know, there was radiation in you. And I said, what? And I freaked.
Who are you talking to?
The nurse who injected me. So I got really freaked out because, you know, I didn't realize that you're radiating the moment they put the substance in you. So she was pregnant. We rode all the way to Gilroy, went shopping for a few hours and came back. So I've always been really afraid. I'm like, wow, I hope I didn't hurt my son.
Hurt your son. Okay, first of all, I'm trying to figure out why anyone would use radioactive isotopes on you for a CT scan. Normally...
Or maybe it was an MRI, I can't remember.
Well, did you go through a big circular object? Okay. So it was either an MRI or a CT scan. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I'm trying to figure out why anyone would use radioisotopes in you for an MRI or a CT scan, and I'm having trouble figuring that out. We inject contrast in the case of an MRI, it's gadolinium, and in the case of a CT scan, it's iodine. And both of these are non-radioactive, and they're designed to cause the blood vessels to show up differently than the surrounding tissue when you do the scan. And neither of these are radioactive. They don't give off any ions. We use radioactive iodine, and we use something called technetium sometimes. And these are radioactive radioisotopes that are very short-lived, so they decay rapidly. And during the period of time, like 24 hours that the stuff is decaying, your urine will register on a Geiger counter. We don't really tell people that they can't flush their urine down the toilet because the radioactive isotope evaporates so quickly. In terms of any kind of exposure that's sitting next to you during that time that your wife would have been exposed to, most of the ionizing radiation is going to be absorbed by your body tissue. You're a big sponge, essentially.
Oh, I see.
And so what little that would get out into the environment and potentially bounce off your wife as opposed to bouncing off the dashboard in the car is pretty minuscule.
Oh, that's good news.
And then beyond that, if you spend a day lying in the sun, just getting a tan with sunscreen on, you're exposed to something called cosmic rays, which sunscreen don't bounce off. And the cosmic rays will have potential of causing cancer.
Oh,
if you fly in an airplane, if you fly from New York to Los Angeles, you're up there in the stratosphere for 5 of the 6 hours of the flight. And during that time, you're not protected by the sunscreen of the atmosphere from cosmic rays. And we've got a lovely cohort of people who have traveled air travel. We've got stewardesses. That's a great group because you can track them. And they get pregnant and they work while pregnant. And you know what? You're cool. There's no increase in birth defects.
Really good.
There's no increase. So there's this difference between the probability and the possibility, okay? And yes, there's a possibility that an alpha wave from a radioactive compound that's in your technetium would go out and bounce off the DNA of your developing child. However, the DNA contains its own repair mechanisms because that happens all the time anyway.
Oh, I see.
So the chance that the ionizing radiation or the, this would be alpha particles. So the case of an alpha particle coming from your body and actually hurting your child compared to the particles that are coming from the sun all the time and passing through you and your wife's body, hurting the child. Proportionality here?
It's pretty negligible, huh?
It's totally negligible.
So you know we're going to have a journal write on Monday with my kids. All right, kids, so here's what happened this weekend.
Well, all I can say is congratulations on your healthy son.
Thank you very much. Keep talking about that healthcare debate. It's a mess.
Like I said, it's weapons of mass destruction. You remember that one?
Yep.
It's like, well, wait a minute. There's no evidence. What? Weapons of mass destruction. But there's no data. But the guys who are the experts on the ground say there's no, but weapons of mass destruction. You know, and it's like, okay, I've been down this road before. I remember this. I remember marching in the streets. It didn't do any good. So it's like, okay, then we're stupid and we get the healthcare system we deserve. Either we're smart or we're stupid. Let's find out.
Just to add one last comment, and because I know you have another caller, but just one last thing. I mean, here's the thing. The sad truth is, at some point, the American public, we are going to have to give up some, you know, tax revenue or something. I mean, it might cost a little more, but I think, you know, like Britain and Canada, you have to weigh it out. Okay, the good of the general public versus me losing a little bit of money, but everybody has universal health care. That's a nice trade-off. I mean, as long as it's managed properly, I mean, and that's one of the things the American public that we always refuse. We don't want to, you know, neither do I, but we don't want to pay taxes, you know? But if we have to pay a little bit to make sure that everybody has that health, you know, that grandma can live long and, you know, and have a fruitful golden era, then that's fine.
I love to hear that. I like to hear someone who's thinking in terms of society as a whole instead of me, me, me.
Exactly.
The World War II generation had it right, okay?
Yeah.
They were fighting for freedom, they were fighting for justice, and they understood that they had to give up some gasoline and some nylon stockings in order that the people who were out there on the front could have materials for the war. And there was this understanding of shared sacrifice, and it actually made people come together.
Exactly.
And everybody was better off for it. Somewhere between 1945 and 2005, we've lost our way. And I hope we can find it again.
I hope so, too.
Thank you very much for the call.
Hey, thank you. It was great to meet you, finally.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Before we go to our next caller, I actually do want to talk a little bit about the coming flu season, because we should be thinking about that right about now. And it's important to bring you up to date on a couple of issues, one of which is the current flu vaccine that I just received in my office does not have H1N1. So this year we're going to have the fun and games of trying to get everybody who needs to be vaccinated with two different flu vaccines. And just to make matters more fun, the recommendations for who should get the flu vaccines are different. So recommendations, children under 1 year of age, adults over 65, anybody with an autoimmune or an immune compromise like cancer or diabetes, that's the current flu vaccine that is out there and now arriving in medical offices near you. And if you fit into those categories, you should get the vaccine. There's a huge debate about the swine flu. Things are not working out well technically. Estimates of how much flu vaccine they were going to be able to deliver by October have recently been cut in half. We were hoping for 195 million doses. We're probably going to get 45 million doses. And there's nothing to do about this. This is not incompetence on the part of the companies. It's just that the virus won't grow fast enough in the eggs for them to make enough vaccine. Bummer. So we're stuck with, you know, a real ceiling here on the supply, which means we have to figure out how best to distribute it. A recent paper set up an interesting debate. This study did a mathematical analysis. It showed in the journal Science, which is a very big and important and well peer-reviewed journal, this last week. And what they did was they took a mathematical model of the spread of a novel flu, H1N1 in this case. The researchers tried to figure out how best to limit the number of cases of H1N1 flu that would occur in a population. And what they came up with was, if you vaccinate children between ages 5 and 19, in other words, kids in school, and adults age 30 to 39, in other words, parents of young children, they are the vectors in our society of the influenza. So a new influenza is going to hit that group and be spread most rapidly by that group. If you only have 45 million doses, it might make more sense to vaccinate that group because you limit the spread of the disease and prevent a major epidemic. On the other hand, if you do that, you'd be disadvantaging the group that is being recommended. What the CDC is saying is people who care for babies, young children, healthcare workers, and then after that, children and young adults aged 6 months to 24 years, and then the people with the chronic diseases. Because this flu is different. We are seeing more severe cases in younger and quote-unquote healthier people and more deaths in that group than we see with the older flus. And that could be cytokine storm. We've discussed the possibility whys of that before. But we're really at a crossroads here. The CDC recommendations do not take into account the probabilities. And what we're looking at here is a real bioethics debate. Do we benefit society, take a utilitarian view, which would be vaccinating the vectors, or do we benefit the individual, take a humanitarian view, and vaccinate the most vulnerable individuals who are most likely to die? Well, stay tuned, but I think we're in for a hot time in the old town tonight on this debate. And speaking of hot times, let's go to Doug. Hello, Doug in Santa Cruz.
I was wondering about the fire and the fire retardant and all of the particulate that's in the air in Santa Cruz here.
Uh-huh.
And maybe you could discuss what you can do about that to, you know, counteract it or...
That's a really, really excellent question. First of all, the nice thing about fires is that they create soot and ash, which is actually visible. You can tell when you're in an issue area, because you can see it on surfaces, you can
taste it. Yeah, I go to the ocean every day because it's better air there than it is in town.
Yeah, exactly. And I grew up in Los Angeles in the 60s, and let me tell you, I know bad air. And
that's what it feels like. Yeah, I said, man, Los Angeles came up here.
I'm flashing back. I was flashing back to my childhood all last week. So that being said, yes, we've all taken a hit in our lungs. And what do we want to do about it? Well, the obvious thing is you want to avoid more load, because just like we were talking about with the CT scan earlier, your body can deal with so much stuff and depends on how healthy you are, how much you can deal with. But the people with asthma, anyone with reactive airway disease right now, anyone with a history of asthma should probably be using an anti-inflammatory either if they want to do vitamins, they should be perhaps on 400 milligrams of quercetin a day. People who have actual reactive airway disease should probably be using their steroid inhaler once or twice a day in order to keep their lungs from firing up, because the risk of the steroid is not meaningful in the short term, and the inflammatory concerns are very great in that vulnerable population. For those of us who don't have reactive airway disease, it's probably reasonable to protect ourselves when we see ashes or soot. And an N95 mask, this is the one that we recommended during the SARS epidemic, and that when people are traveling during a flu epidemic, I recommend carrying on the airplane in case you're sitting next to somebody who's coughing up a storm. This will keep out a lot of particles. It's not perfect, but really what you're trying to do is...
N95?
N95. It's an OSHA occupational health and safety designation. You can buy these masks at your local paint store. Your local hardware store will have them. And it will keep out particles of the size that you're going to encounter in bulk after a fire.
That includes the flame retardant?
The flame retardant, I don't know about.
The Sentinel has put out no real news about that part of it. I mean, they talk about, you know, the smoke and everything, but there's a flame retardant that's going to be embedded in those little, you know, fog particles and smoke particles, and they're going to be blowing out on us too, you know, and I'm
saying... I'm not sure of that. Mm-hmm. I believe that the flame retardant is probably designed to
go down
and stick. I mean, why else would you use it? So I really need to look more into that, because you've brought up a good question and I have to do some research. I can't really answer it off the top of my head. I don't have a good answer for you.
Okay.
All right. But why don't you tune in
next week,
and I will work on it, and I'll call Hal. I've got this wonderful resource who knows everything about environmental toxicology, or seems to, so maybe he'll have some information. So, Hal, I'm putting out an SOS to you, and I'll send you an email, too. But other resources, anyone out there who has information about fire retardant, please go to my website, askdrdon.com, and give me a contact, and I'll get a hold of you, because I am very interested in this, and I'd like to piggyback off other people's knowledge if I possibly can.
I'm a normal, healthy vegetarian, and I was thinking that I should maybe eat a little more cheese. Not a lot more, but just a little more cheese that'll give me a little extra mucus for protection, light layer of protection. Does that make sense?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
I think you should get some salt water and do sinus lavage.
Okay, do the sinus wash.
Yeah, do the neti wash. That's a smarter idea. Get the particles out of your nose before you swallow them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Roseanne in Aptos sent an email. And I didn't get to this before I went off on vacation, so I want to answer it now. Roseanne is a 56-year-old postmenopausal woman, and she has osteopenia in her hips, and her doctor had suggested Fosamax. She didn't want to do the drug, so she started on alternative treatment. So she's doing calcium, magnesium, and 800 units of vitamin D. I think you could do more vitamin D there. Roseanne, I'm having people take about 2,000 if they have osteopenia. And she's doing exercise, weight bearing, and all of that. And she wants to know, is there a way she can tell how she's doing? And the answer is, there is a urine test that looks at bone breakdown. It costs about a couple $100, and if you have osteopenia, will probably be covered by your insurance. The test is for pyridolinium and deoxypyridine crosslinks. Those names are on the Ask Dr. Don resources page on the website because they're hard to find, but those are good bone markers, and they tell you whether you're building bone and breaking down bone at an even rate, in other words, in balance, or whether you are losing bone faster than you're building it, in which case those markers will be high. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. I will do that research, and I promise to get back to you next week with information about fire retardants that are sprayed on fires, not the kind that are in clothing, because we already know there are problems with those. This is Dr. Don saying so long, and stay healthy.